Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico is brought to you by Light Street Media. This podcast is supported by Joe's Albums. You know how much I love vinyl and go in the record stores. Well, my favorite stop these days is Joe's Albums. Joe has two fantastic locations. The original store at 317 Main Street in Worcester, Massachusetts, and their newer stop out in the hipster college town of Northampton at 5 Market Street. Both stores have a great new releases section and a huge assortment of used records. You want to check out some cool record stores? Check out Joe's Albums in Worcester and Northampton, Massachusetts. And if you really want to geek out, go to joesalbums.com. We're also supported by Baby Loves Tacos, the fantastic Mexican-style cuisine joint located at 4508 Liberty Avenue in the Bloomfield section of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Check out the Baby Loves Tacos website at babylovestacospgh.com. Baby Loves Tacos, where everybody eats. I am really excited to talk about my new sponsor, Studio Float. There are so many of us creatives and podcasters who need a quiet home studio. Or maybe you're in a band that needs a soundproof rehearsal space so you can create whatever the mood strikes. First, most of us creatives, noise control is a big issue. Studio Float is the simple solution. Studio Float makes inexpensive, high-performance, patented sound-isolating products called ISORAFs for use in new and retrofit applications. Studio Float ISORAFs completely isolate floors, walls, and ceilings, creating a truly floating shell within a shell while preventing sound transfer to and from one space to an adjacent space. Visit studio-float.com for more details and assistance with designing your project. Use the code BLOWINGSMOKE10 in the online form for a 10% off your order. Studio Float. Life is loud. Float above the noise. That's studio-float.com. We'll be right back. It had to happen. Fancy Pants himself, Tim Katz, joins us on the show today. Welcome to Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. That song is one of my all-time favorite tunes by a Boston band. Hell, it's one of my all-time favorite tunes in general. Fancy Pants from Boston stoner rock legends Roadsaw. And yes, it's true, bassist Tim Katz joins us on the show today for a great conversation about his long music career. Tim got an early start and a whiff at success with the band Seika, who changed their name to Strip Mine after they were sued by the famous porn star of the same name. And we get into the whole Seika story in our interview, and it's definitely an interesting story. Tim later went on to play for years in the band Roadsaw and a host of other bands, including White Dynamite, who he's currently playing with. He has also written a couple books and was the man that started the scene at O'Brien's in Alston, where many touring bands now play regularly. Plus, he worked at Curve of the Earth Records and actually signed the first band that I used to manage, 3 1/2 Girls. So what do you say we get right to it? Here I am talking with Tim Katz. All right, Mr. Katz.
Hi.
How are you?
Doing great. How you doing?
Good, man. So you grew up in New Hampshire?
I grew up in New Bedford and then moved to New Hampshire and then moved back to...
Oh, I wasn't sure about whether you grew up... So you did grow up in Mass, but did you go to school in New Hampshire?
Both. I was only up there for a little bit because it was the parents' divorce thing, you know?
Oh.
So I split time between the two and ended up in Boston eventually, so...
When you were young and growing up, when did you first start hearing music, and what kind of music were you listening to?
The usual. Zeppelin, Aerosmith, Kiss.
The classic rock era.
Yeah, first album, Kiss Alive, you know.
Me too. So, well, one of my first.
Yeah. I mean, it was all pretty typical until I discovered David Bowie.
Oh.
I had a neighbor who had a massive record collection, and... he'd hire me to do odd jobs around his property. And I found a David Bowie record in his collection, and that was it, you know.
So this would probably be, what, the late 70s, early 80s,
late
something
70s,
like that?
Yep, definitely late 70s. Wow. It hurts just to say that.
I know, you know, and I know you're a Queen fan, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because we've talked about Queen before.
One of my first concerts.
Yeah. Did you like John Deacon's bass playing, or were you just a fan of the band?
Just a fan of the band. It was more about just Queen being Queen. But for bass playing, it was Phil Lynott. It was Geezer Butler. And then, you know, after I went through my glam phase of T-Rex, Gary Glitter, Sweet. That's one of my first records, is Sweet, Desolation Boulevard. Huge influence.
AC/DC and all those tunes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and Fox on
Action.
The Run.
Action.
Yep.
Yeah, so, that's a good one.
After that, you know, and then it was the Ramones. Then it was The Clash and stuff like that. So
you mentioned Phil Lynott and Queen, and one of the first shows that I saw was Queen and Thin Lizzy together.
Nice.
Yeah, I saw Queen 3 times. So.
Did you see him at the Garden?
I saw the Garden once, Providence Civic Center, Springfield Civics. Because, you know, I grew up in Mass,
yeah,
too,
yeah, yeah.
Before I moved to California.
Yep.
So, you know, as a matter of fact, just going backwards, going forward for a minute, I was driving here this morning. I was thinking, when was the first time I met Tim? And I remembered, and I don't know if you remember, it was at the Foundations Convention in California.
Foundations Forum, yeah.
Yes. And David Robertson was your manager at the time, Strip Mine, Seika Strip Mine.
Yep.
And I saw David, and then he introduced, and I think it was you, and I think it was all four of you, actually.
Right. That was a blast. I mean, those were the glory days, you know, especially for metalheads. You know, I'd never had any intention of being in a thrash metal band, but I knew Stu and Billy and, you know, getting into Seika, and then, you know,
We're gonna talk about Seika, because I have some questions for you about that. So you said did you start playing bass at a young age, or guitar or something?
Grew up a Catholic boy, and for confirmation, I got a bass, and I saw it in a window, and I had no idea if it was a guitar or bass. I want that.
How old were you?
I was 12.
So you started pretty young.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool.
So, yeah, that was...
But you play guitar too, right?
I play it all. What do you got? You got a tuba? I'll get something out of it.
Drums?
Yeah, I can play drums.
Nice.
Yeah.
So. Nice. But the bass was what got your attention.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you mentioned some of those bass players that you're listening to.
Yeah.
Geezer. Now, had you already left New Hampshire at this point to come back to Mass, or are you still up in New Hampshire?
I'm up in New Hampshire and, you know, playing a couple of garage bands and high school bands and stuff like that. And then I was in a band with this guy, Dave Kirkpatrick, and he graduated, went to Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And so after he left, he was my best friend in high school. So when he left, I was like, what am I doing here? You know? So I would hitchhike to Boston and hang out with him on the
hitchhike.
Weekends. Yeah. Hitchhiking.
Yeah, I don't recommend it. I used to hitchhike too. I remember those days. I do not recommend
a long haired skinny boy in tight jeans wearing girl shirts and eyeliner to hitchhike. At all. You know, I was a glam kid, so.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, you're still kind of glammy.
You saw me on the side of the road. You're, you know, definitely pulling over. So.
When was that you actually moved to Boston?
Well, first time, when I started hanging out with Dave when he was going to Berkeley, and then I ended up just moving here permanently. I lived on Haviland Street, which was right next door to TC's Lounge.
Oh, wow.
And you could live on $5 a day because you could get two slices of pizza and a Coke for $1.50. And yeah. And
what year would you say that was?
That was 84.
Oh, you were here that long ago.
Yes. Wow. Because I remember my graduating class is 83. And our motto was, we're young, we're wild, we're free. We're the class of 83. Stealing it right from the Triumph song there. But yeah.
Triumph. Yeah. That was a good band that we don't talk about that much. Oh, I'm sure that you and I could discuss a lot of obscure, cool bands. I was listening to Fairport Convention last night, and I forgot how good that band was.
Well, see, you know, as you get older, I went through a recent phase of listening to 70s English folk rock, you know? So that's where we are. Here we are.
Yeah, you know, the record I have was this live record from 74, and Richard and Linda Thompson weren't even on it. Sandy Denny was singing
Denny,
on it.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I thought I bought a record. I didn't look at there was no listing of who was on it in the back. I had to go home and look it up. And then I saw Richard Thompson was already gone, and I didn't have but the record was great.
Well, and Richard and Linda put out I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight and many great records like that. Absolutely.
I like that song that Richard Thompson has about the 52 Vincent.
Yep.
That's a killer song.
It's a great song.
Yeah.
I love it.
One of the great all-Americana songs. So when you moved to Boston, like I know Seika, but were you in bands before Seika?
Yeah, I bumped in around a couple bands, and then I was in a band with Bob Daly, who went on to play drums in Chloe, and Dave Kirkpatrick from high school. We were in a band called Cluster. And Dave was running a studio under the Grecian Yearning in Alston called The Lanes. And we made our records there, our demos there. This is in the days of like busting out cassettes.
Right.
So
right.
Alston Cassette was right next door to The Lanes studio. So we would record and then have 100 cassettes made and hand them out. At the same time, I was friends with Stu Shopes.
Yeah.
He was working Store 24, and he asked me if I wanted to play in Seika. So that's when I joined Seika.
What's the time on that?
85, 6, 7. Yeah, probably around 86, 87.
So Seika. I've heard so many different stories. I can't wait to hear your version of it.
What's the story you want to hear?
Well, I want to know about what happened with the porn star Seika. I want to know about Tang, and I want to know about the name change mostly. So, and Jane was your manager?
Jane Gulick, the fabulous, wonderful Jane Gulick.
Yeah, who's also in the film industry, which you were in for a long time as well.
She still is.
Yeah.
She's out in L.A.
So how did the band come together? Was it that lineup? TC was the your TC. TJ,
yes,
was the drummer originally.
Yep, Tim Jordan.
Yep. Right.
So they already had the nucleus of the band. Stu had played guitar on a Cluster track, and so we had already been in the studio together. And So they got rid of their bass player because he, because he was married. So they were like, oh, he can't commit. So I came in. So it was me, Tim Jordan, Stu Shopes, Billy O'Malley. And they already had the name Seika. We obviously played a bunch of gigs, had a good following, played a bunch of parties and stuff.
So they were kind of established when you already joined?
Just getting established.
Okay.
Just getting established. But, you know, it didn't take long for, especially with Jane's help, to get things really rolling. And, you know, back in the day when there were loft parties where there'd be 200 people and, you know, 30 kegs of beer and playing at 3 in the morning, places like the Res, you know, and stuff like
this
that.
This is like late 80s we're talking.
Late 80s, yeah. And eventually played the Rumble and won the Rumble.
Won the Rumble.
Yep.
Do you remember who you beat in the finals?
Uncle Betty.
Uncle Betty.
Yep,
Uncle Betty. They were around for a while.
They were great.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget. So in the finals, Uncle Betty, it was at the Paradise. Uncle Betty opens with Rockin' the Paradise by Styx, which was great. And Matt, the singer for Uncle Betty, Iggy Pop was the MC that year.
Wow.
And I remember Matt saying, talking to Iggy, hey, Mr. Pop. Thanks, Mr. Pop. You know, and yeah. So, but that was kind of like the thing that kicked it off, because Howie Klein from Zaya Records was one of the he was one of the judges and offered us a record deal on Warner Brothers.
Really?
Right there on the spot.
So were you already on Tang at this point?
Well, we had recorded a record for Tang with Ross Humphreys.
Love Shim. Yeah.
With Ross Humphreys, God rest his soul. And when we won the Rumble, Curtis decided to hang on to the record. Like, instead of releasing the record to capitalize on the Rumble situation, he held on to it. And we spent the following year negotiating with Tang to go to Warner Brothers.
So he never released the record for a year?
He did release it, but it was a year after the Rumble.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Well, I probably knew that, but I can't remember everything.
Yeah, it was. He held us up.
So you had an offer. Did you sign while he already owned? Did he own the master?
He owned the master to the first record, and if I'm recalling this correctly, wanted $1 million from Warner Brothers to let us out.
Sounds like Curtis.
And eventually, it was negotiated down to taking money out of our recording budgets for Warner Brothers.
Oh, really?
And he walked away with 6 figures.
Wow.
A healthy 6 figures.
Then that was just the beginning of, well, I won't say, I guess we
our
could
legal
call
troubles.
Them problems. Yeah, because you guys decided that when you formed the band, or whoever did, Stu or whatever, that you wanted to call yourself Seika, and there was a famous porn star named Seika.
Correct.
I guess she didn't appreciate the fact that you guys were using her name.
So the way that happened was Stu decided that... He decided on the name, and it was largely believed that she was out of the business, kind of maybe dead. You know, she's an obscure porn star. She was big in porn, but it was porn in the 70s. Nobody.
Yeah, they didn't go mainstream back
then. Yeah, and so we found out she was still alive when we tried to sign to Warner Brothers, and also found out that she had put out, so her manager was her husband was her lawyer.
Oh,
right. And and we said, well, she's not a recording artist. No one's going to confuse it. Well, she is. She put out a record.
She did?
Yeah. It was a flexi disc in Hustler.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And it was her like talking dirty over some like porn music. Okay. She's a recording artist. Oh, and she has a line of merchandise. Oh, and, you know, so he had all the bases covered. So we tried to negotiate with her. Look, we'll pay you this amount. You can be in our first video and all this. And they wanted an astronomical amount of money. So
a lot of people wanted your money back then, Tim.
Well, that's the record business. You know, they smell a little money and they all come running. So basically, we had to change the name.
And So did you ever have to give her any money, or did Tang have to give her any money? So he was able to put that record out with the name Seika with no problem. I have that on vinyl at home, actually. How did you come up with the name Strip Mind?
It's a terrible name. It was not.
You said it. I didn't.
It was like we were in the Pyramid Studios in Ithaca, New York, with Alex Perialis.
Oh, I love Alex.
He was he was doing our record, and we had argued about names for a very long time. And the record label called up and said, "What do you got? Today's the day." And that's what stuck. I thought I wasn't a fan of it, but it was somebody's idea who had more say than the rest. So
you ended up, and we're going to talk about this, being more of a spokesman, a leader in other bands in years to come. But back then, you were
I was just a bass player.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I thought.
It wasn't my band. I had written songs for the band, and they were just like, "No, you're not one of the songwriters." So
okay, so let's talk about those guys. It's Billy O'Malley,
Billy and Stu.
Stu and Tim Jordan left, and then someone else pretty famous joined the band.
Sully,
who's now the singer of Godsmack.
Right.
What was Sully like back then when you guys were playing? Did you see his future?
Well, a lot of people like to talk shit about Sully. But, you know, I don't like his music. But I do 100% back his work ethic. When Tim left, he left in the middle of recording at Pyramid.
The band had already become... Oh, he did in the middle of the recording?
What had happened was is that the year we had between negotiating with Tang and Warner Brothers kind of set us back a year and a half recording for Warner Brothers. And in that time, people kind of went to their own corners a little bit. And so when we got back to record the record, we, you know, things had changed. And we got in the studio, and Tim had some drums delivered there, his new drum kit.
Okay.
And it was double kick. It was his big kit. And he was having problems playing the kit. So he had brought his old, you know, this. So 2 days go by in the studio of cutting basics, and he was clearly struggling. And so we went back to his old kit. But by now, he'd been mentally beat up for a couple of days. So we took a break, and in that break, the decision was made that he wasn't going to come back because we'd spent 5 days in the studio trying to get drum tracks, and we didn't get a single one.
Ouch.
Yeah, and it was mental exhaustion, you know. I don't know what was going on with him mentally, but he just wasn't prepared. So when we got Sully, he killed the audition. We get in the studio. He did all of his drum tracks in one day.
Did you have to, like, put the whole recording on hold?
Put it all on hold for, like, 2 months.
Who was your A&R guy at Warner's?
Linnea Nan.
Linnea Nan.
Yeah, and she was great.
At this point, was David Robertson your manager?
He was our manager.
Yeah.
So in a short amount of time, we had been beat up by Tang. Dave Robertson came around and says he had experience because he used to be on the managing team for Aerosmith.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
So,
he was Steven Tyler's right-hand man.
Yep. Yeah, so there was a shuffle in that as well because certain people in the band thought that we had to step up. You know, I was more of a homebody. I was like, let's stick with Jane. Let's record at New Alliance, close to home.
That's right. I didn't ask you. So they didn't fire Jane, did they?
Yes. Or,
yeah. I said they, but you were part of the they too.
Yeah, but I was just the
not trying to
defend myself, but I was just the bass player. I wasn't one of the main guys, and so she was let go, which was terrible. The decision was made to there was this band called Wrathchild.
Yeah, Baltimore band, right?
Yeah, and their record sounded phenomenal, which is why we went to Alex in Ithaca.
Right,
but there was also a conversation that was being had, like, why don't we just stay close to home and put the money, let's use Mudrock at New Alliance. And we didn't. So, you know, the record comes out. It didn't sound great because of all the problems we had been having in the studio. But I will say that Sully came in as the second drummer. He did all of his takes in one take in one day, the entire record.
Wow.
He nailed it. So I got to hand it to him on that. And as a matter of fact, he ended up using Mud Rock at New Alliance to record the Godsmack record.
And right? sell like a million copies, right?
Yeah. And so another weird little tie-in with this is that we were staying at the house next door to Pyramid Studio. And
Ithaca,
New York, upstate. And previous bands had left their VHS collection there. One of those tapes was called the Norma Kuzman Collection, which was basically, and because we were named after a porn star, people would approach us with tapes, VHS tapes at shows and shit. Like we were porn nuts or something, you know? And so this one tape came across the desk, the Norma Kuzman Collection, and it was all Tracy Lord stuff before she turned 18. Right,
so she had made all
these
movies.
She had made all these movies, and then got sued.
Yeah,
and, you know,
I remember.
Happened. But somebody had made like a greatest hits. Essentially, it's child porn if you look at it from a legal standpoint.
You're right.
But so this tape was floating around. Sully had a copy of it, and he had made friends with a DJ at WAAF who had an affinity for porn, and presented this tape to him, and they became buddies. Like, all of a sudden, they were like buddies.
This is a story I never heard. Right?
So Sully's like, hey, here's a demo of my band, Godsmack. You should check it out. And then, so this DJ on AAF starts playing Godsmack. And the next thing you know, but also another Sully story that people don't really realize is that connections to his loyalty. So all the guys that we had on the road crew for Seika, he took with him to Godsmack.
He did.
And when he was being courted by record labels because of the popularity of his song on WAAF, he got a show at CBGB's in New York. And what he did is he rented two buses and put kegs on the buses and sold tickets to his friends in Lowell and Lynn and Lawrence.
Yeah, he's from up that area. Yeah.
And
Haverhill.
Hey, come see us at CBGB's, the legendary CBGB.
Wow.
He sold 200 tickets to the party bus. The bus drives down. They pack CBGB's.
Wow.
And so the label people come in and go like, what's going on here? This place is packed.
Was this late prospective labels, or did he have a deal already?
This is when people were trying to sign Godsmack. So he did the work.
Certainly
and he
did.
And that piqued the interest in Godsmack. And not to keep going on about Sully, but even afterwards, they said, hey, we're going to give you $1 million to shoot a video. He goes, nope, I'm going to shoot it with my own company. And they shot it at one of those AAF outdoor places.
Do you think this is a learning experience from being around Strip Mine that he came up with all this stuff on his own? Or
I think he's a smart, hardworking individual, and he made it work. And he also, like, he didn't sign a deal, a typical deal. Like, he saw that the deal that Strip Mine had got, that he's doing the math. He's like, we're going to have to pay back $500,000. So what does he do? He licenses the Godsmack record. He doesn't sign a record deal. He licenses the record. And what he does is that when they say, we want to make a video, he goes, I already made a video and I'll sell it. It's here. You put it out. I've already paid for it. So he has his buddies shoot a live show at a WAAF outdoor concert. And when it comes time to make Godsmack shirts, typically it's like, oh, we got this big merchandising company. They're going to give you 50% of all the earnings and they'll control all of it. They'll take care of the merchandising.
Right.
No. I have my own merchandising company, and I'm going to make my own shirts, and I'm going to hire my guys. So he's very loyal, very smart. He's
very smart.
And
I never heard any of this before.
Well, it's easy to shit on him because his music's so terrible, but you got to hand it to the guy. Like, even when we were recording this, even when he joined Seika, Strip Mine, we were doing thrash metal, right? And he goes, guys, we should be doing this, and pointing to like Alice in Chains and stuff like that.
That's exactly what he became.
Right? And this and Stu was just like, no, we got signed doing thrash metal. We're doing us. And he's like, dude, but this is where it's going. And they were like, no. And so he had the smarts,
wow,
you know, and he created this opportunity for himself.
Yeah, I'm not a Godsmack fan either. And I heard that the guys did, and I'm not saying you, but I heard that certain guys didn't treat him very well when he was in the band, you know?
Well, I mean, he could be difficult. Let's put it, he's the only person in a band that I've gotten in a fist fight with.
Oh,
fight. I've been in a lot of bands, but he's the only
he's
guy.
He's not that tall either, right?
No, he's not.
So you guys are almost the same.
I'm
not saying you're short. Well, you know, I'm 5'8", and I think
he's probably like 5'4".
Yeah.
But he's a strong dude. He was back in the day.
Are you saying you lost the fight?
Well, it didn't really turn into much of a fight because we were in the van going 90 miles an hour.
Are the best kind of van fights, man. Those are the best kind.
No, he can be difficult, but I got to hand it to him. And you know what? His loyalty even goes so far as... So we hired Alex Perialis to record the record, who had done the Wrathchild record. So we also toured with a band called Lillian Axe.
Oh, yeah. Didn't David manage them too?
Yes, he did. Yeah. So Tommy, who played drums for Lillian Axe...
Louisiana, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
He ended up playing for Godsmack.
Oh.
Because we had met them on the road. We were on tour with them. And then when Tommy left, he called up Shannon Larkin from Wrathchild to play drums for Godsmack.
So Sully, resourcefulness.
Very resourceful.
Sounds like that's his whole deal.
Yep.
Wow. Okay, let's just put a bow on the Strip Mind thing for a second. what happened?
To who?
To Strip Mind.
It was done.
One and done.
Sully quit.
Oh, he quit the band.
He quit, fired, depending on who you talk to. And that was it.
And then you lost David, and that was the end of it.
We lost Billy.
Billy
O'Malley, who was basically the heart and soul.
Yeah, and he had that real star quality going on about him.
Yep.
You guys look good, but Billy, no shirt on usually. Like,
I always like to, and this is true of even Roadsaw later when we were on tour, being on stage and looking out at the audience. So the singer in the middle has the wild guys. They're like, yeah, yelling and pumping their fist. Billy had all the girls in front of him going, Billy.
I believe that.
Me, I had the weirdos. I had the guy with one leg and, you know, the castaways on my side. So, yep.
Wow. Well, okay, we got to talk about a band that you were in for a lot longer than that band. Roadsaw was next, right?
Yeah.
Was there anything in between Strip Mind and Roadsaw for you?
I had done Black Salad, which was Sabbath tribute band.
Yes.
But other than that, no. I went straight from... I started doing Roadsaw right when Seika stopped.
Was the original lineup you, Craig Riggs,
Steve Malone. Yep.
And that's it? Was it a three-piece originally?
At first, and then we were drinking at Father's outside of Kenmore Square, and Daryl Shepherd was there, and he goes, I want to be in your band. And we were like, okay.
So this is before you recorded anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you know Craig? Because you and Craig have been like working together
for a long time.
I knew
Craig from the Rez. Him and Todd had a space on Albany Street, the end of Thayer Street, called the Rez, which was a party, you know, through massive parties. I had also knew him just from around his band Joe. We'd played with Joe a bunch of times. So I knew him just from around, you know.
Just the Roadsaw thing, 6 studio albums?
Probably.
And there were a bunch of singles and EP compilations. Fancy Pants, your tune. Was that the first single?
That was the first single.
Yeah, I love that one, man.
That was a good one.
I like a lot of the Roadsaw stuff. I mean, I've always thought Roadsaw was one of the best bands. I wanted to ask you about how you guys were able to endure the lineup changes over the years, because there was quite a few lineup changes, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were together so long.
And Craig are the two consistent members.
Yep. You know, it always seemed to get better with the lineup changes. So that was kind of one of the things that we kind of stuck to, me and Craig, was like, if we're going to switch people out, it's got to get better. To me, the best lineup was, Ian Ross on guitar, Hari, Hassan on drums.
Yeah, Hari.
And he was, yeah, phenomenal drummer. So that was the rock and roll record came out of that lineup, and it's, I think it's our best.
Yeah, I liked what Ian brought to the band. No offense against Daryl and Steve,
and actually,
Daryl, I love those guys.
Daryl and Ian were in the band together for a while. So yeah, it was pretty good.
Not to change the subject, but I have to. I'm very interested to see how Daryl and Steve Rasteen work together in their new band that they have,
yes.
The Long Wait.
Yeah.
Because I like Daryl, you know, I've seen so, and you have too, because I know you were there at some of his worst moments, because we were there.
Correct.
But Daryl and I are friends, so we've talked about this stuff before, so he's not going to take it personally. But he's always been like a guitar player that I've admired for his big, heavy sound, you know? And him and Ian complimented each other quite well. I saw that version of the band several times.
He's an amazing guitar player, and he's one of those guys that, the minute you hear a lead, you're like, that's Daryl. You know, he could be playing through a $200 guitar and a transistor radio, and you would still know that it was him playing. He's got a signature sound. I don't know. It's all in the fingers, but great guitar player.
And him and Greg Dukine together.
Yes, they do. Yep. Which is also, they're great.
Yeah, I know. I like them a lot. They're the great stoner rock band. Not that
Roadsaw
wasn't a stoner rock band. Roadsaw, you guys did accomplish a lot. I mean, people might not realize it, but you guys, I remember really early before I even got to know you very well, you guys and Tree decided to go on a tour together.
Yep.
Talk about that. What was that like?
So it was Tree, Stompbox, and us.
Sorry, I forgot about Stompbox.
Yeah,
they're
but they were going
band.
Through something at the time too, because they... they had been dropped by Sony. And that's the other thing, too. When Seika was going, Orangutan had just gotten signed. Stompbox had just gotten signed. The Boss Tones were signed. Power Man 5000. So there was a lot going on at that time. But, that was our first national tour. And it was fantastic. We couldn't be on a better tour with better
Did
guys.
You just have two vans and you guys...
Three vans. Yep, all bands in their own vans and just kind of convoy across.
Three bands. Yeah. So... I'm trying to think. Tree was more hardcore. You guys were more stoner, and Stompbox was more like helmety.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really like three identical bands. So it's kind of a cool tour.
Yeah.
Were you guys able to get people to come to the shows?
Yes and no. Depends on the day of the week, and it depends on the location.
But it was a good learning experience.
It was
at
great.
The time.
Yeah, and I had the van from the Seika days. Like nobody in the band wanted to sign on their information onto the registration and stuff. So when the band broke up, I'm like, this van's mine, motherfucker.
Nice.
So it was like, we had that. That tour brought us to San Francisco, where I met Frank Kozik and Lydia Russell at Man's Ruin.
Oh, yeah.
And
you ended up having records on Man's Ruin.
Yep. And so Frank put out the single for us for Not Today.
How many different labels was Roadsaw on? I mean, I know about Curve and Man's Ruin. You're in a Detroit label too, right?
Small Stone. Probably like 84 different labels, I'm sure. we had deals in Europe with other record labels. We put out split singles with people. Anybody that asked us to do anything, we did it. So we were very fortunate because Craig had a recording studio.
Right, so, Matt Oak, right?
Yeah, so
which is still going strong.
Yep, absolutely. So we were able to, if somebody's like, hey, we're putting out a compilation record, you want to throw something on there? Yeah, sure. You know, so we would go in, write a song, and put it out there.
Now, Roadsaw's still together, basically. You just on a little hiatus? Or?
Well, we never broke up, but we all kind of went to our separate corners. We're older. Some guys like to... drive, some don't, you know, so it's on hiatus.
But you you're not saying you've played your last show though.
No, I'm just saying that I'm doing other stuff. I'm doing White Dynamite with Craig's in White Dynamite.
We're gonna get to that. Yeah.
And Craig's doing Kind. Ian lives up in Portland and he plays guitar in a band called Murcielago. So you know, everybody kinda just started doing other stuff. The thing that me and Craig always said, well, some bands love to announce, we're breaking up.
You know what?
And then 2 years later, they're like doing shows again. So it's like.
Yeah, I was at the last Mission of Burma show in 1983. Right. So I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. Motley Crue is still on the road for some reason.
I can imagine Rhodes. Well, I'm not part of the band, so I can't. Yeah. I can only imagine that Roadsaw will play another show someday. I feel like there will be a Roadsaw show at some point.
There could be. It's one of those things.
When the box set comes out.
Well, you know, I recently moved from one house to another, and I have so many cassette tapes of so many songs that we've written in a haze of pot smoke that just never saw the light of day. So
I got to say, I remember going to a lot of good parties in the Roadsaw rehearsal space in the New Alliance building on 1312 Boylston.
That's
that was
right.
The place where everyone would show up at like 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning.
Yep. It
especially when the Linwood shows were happening, it would be easy to just walk right over there.
Absolutely.
People were like, Linwood? 1312, what?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot happening.
That's
when
we got to know each other, really, through Curve, because you signed Three and a Half Girls, the first band I managed, to Curve of the Earth.
Yep.
And that was when Roadsaw was, I think, on maybe their second record or something?
Probably working on their second record. Yeah. I was also booking O'Brien's.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that because you had a really successful run at O'Brien's. I mean, I remember going there every Thursday night. It would be like, that would be the place to be, man, on Thursdays.
It was Alston, when I first moved to Alston, had several
Did you
clubs.
Start the O'Brien scene, basically?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so.
I'm going to take full credit for that.
You should, because those shows were unbelievable over there.
O'Brien's used to be a shitty light beer, bad cocaine, townie bar. That
had a good location.
Had a good location and had Sunday nights, they had like a Deadhead cover band. So I walked in there and was like, can I do shows here? I just want one night a week. So we were doing Thursday nights. And then the owner, Frank, was like, how about you doing Friday and Saturday too? So we ended up doing Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And the townie guys didn't like it at all. They were, this is their bar. But eventually it ended up being seven nights a week and still going strong to this day.
Yeah. I remember being at some absolutely epic shows at that club.
We had some phenomenal shows. There was one particular show called the Kung Fu Barbecue.
Yeah, remember that.
And it was like Scissor Fight, Tree, Quintain, Honky Ball, Quintain, Roadsaw. It's just like down the list.
Yeah, I remember that show. There's great posters, man.
Yeah.
Sticky, was that her
Sticky
name?
Did the posters.
Sticky used to do like these phenomenal posters. I've got a bunch of them. I save all my posters.
We had 200 people in there. Capacity is 55. And cooking meat, have Kung Fu on the TVs. And the cops came in and busted it up. And that was sort of the end of that. But that was a phenomenal time.
You helped me a lot because I had a bunch of different bands at that time. They all played at O'Brien's.
Yep, Three and a Half Girls used to murder that place.
Yeah, I remember seeing some unforgettable shows there. That was it for you for booking, though. You didn't book any other clubs, did you?
It
sucked because I booked the Linwood, and after that, I didn't want anything to do with booking.
Yeah.
If so many people just don't like you.
Well, yeah,
and
you can't please everybody. So.
Right.
For a time there, I was booking O'Brien's. I was playing in Honey Glazed and Roadsaw, and I was helping out Half Cocked. I helped them do their first record.
I remember that time period.
And Veragogo. I helped them with their record. So it's like I was doing a lot of stuff.
Ross worked with them too. You and Ross were pretty tight, right?
Yep.
And did you have a lot to do with him working with a lot of these bands, or was he already established when you met him? Or
yeah, and Ross was one of those guys who
Ross Humphrey we're talking about,
had been around a long time, but was blessed genetically. He always looked young, and was a good looking guy, but he was much older than me.
Well, I do know, and I'm not going to mention her name, I do know an 18-year-old girl that wrote a song called 52, and it's about Ross Humphrey.
No kidding. Yep.
She was only like 18 or 19 at the time.
Yeah,
so.
And he was...
I'm not going to mention her name, but...
He was a great engineer. We did the Saker record with him. I did the Honey Glaze record with him. I did a lot of projects with him.
Because you mentioned Verigogo. I know he produced Verigogo, yep, too. Talk about some of your other bands here before we get to White Dynamite, which is right, really cool band that you're in. Antler, I don't know much about, but you put two records out.
Yeah. After Roadside went on hiatus, I moved to L.A. and...
I remember that. You see, I wasn't living here either because I moved, but I wasn't in L.A. when you were in L.A. I think I was in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
But Antler, I missed Antler for some reason.
Roadside went through a phase where we were kind of didn't have a label, didn't have a tour. I ended up moving to New York with my girlfriend, came back, moved to L.A., at that time, Mud Rock was out there. Scott Gilman was out there. Some of the collage from Honey Glaze was out there.
Christine McCarthy.
Christine McCarthy was out there. So I had a lot of friends out. Power Man was out there. Half Cocked was out there.
You didn't like L.A. though.
I did and I didn't. It was a weird time in my life.
Like, I remember you. I remember I ran into you one night after that, years later, when I was working with the Charms.
Yeah,
we were at a show together, and you told me you didn't like L.A. then, but maybe you changed your mind.
No, I mean, it was just I didn't like it because I wasn't in a good place for it. You know, I ended up going out there with a shoebox full of money and blowing it all. And
you could do that in L.A.
Yeah, it was just. It was easy to blow through that money.
Yeah, blow through that money.
Yeah,
yeah. No pun intended. So Antler, what label was Antler on?
Tortuga, which was
right.
Mark Thompson's label.
Right.
So when I came back from L.A., I was like, I had written a bunch of songs that were more leaning towards a country rock kind of sound. And it ended up being, you know, the second record ended up being three quarters of Roadsaw. Me, Craig, and Ian, and people would come to the shows. We made some good records, but people were like, well, how come you guys ain't doing Roadsaw? So we just put that behind us.
They don't know what they have till it's gone,
yeah.
Those people. Were there any other bands? I knew you mentioned Honey Glazed. I know you got some solo stuff. I was going to ask you about that in a minute, but was there other bands between that period up until White Dynamite?
Jeez, I played in a band called Black House for a little, which was three bass players and a drummer.
That sounds nice and noisy.
Yeah, with Kevin Grant, who's in Wirelines now, which was a lot of fun. Other than that, I mean, I did one-off stuff. I had a band called Dead Pegasus, which was just gloomy acoustic stuff with Dave Unger.
Who you're playing with now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what else? Jeez. I did Black Salad. I did a thing with way back when. It was me, Jim Janota, Janet Egan, and Justine Kovalt. Jim was going out with Janet. I was going
Tim
out with Justine.
Tim and the Unclean?
No, it was called Boo.
So you play with three members of Justine and the Unclean,
yeah,
basically.
Yep.
Wow.
And it was a cover band called Boo. We did a Halloween gig, and it was all Sonics covers. And but yeah, it was just stuff like that, you know.
Justine Kovalt has really reinvented herself in an unbelievable way, huh?
Unbelievable. Like her and I dated for years back in the day. I was in Seca. She was in Malachite.
Yeah, I remember that band.
Absolutely phenomenal band.
The original singer, she vanished, yep, or something, right?
Yep, Linnea. They were scheduled to go, my understanding is they were scheduled to go record with Steve Albini, and she disappeared. Like, they were on the brink of just being huge. And I think they would have been, you know?
The second version with Nancy Fanara, rest in peace, and Jan Cobran was not that bad either.
Yeah, they were good.
I got demos of both of those bands.
Yep.
But somehow they ended up in L.A. on my desk, but I never did anything, so fuck you, Steve. You know, you blew that one. I love all girl bands, so I don't know what I was thinking.
Yeah, Malachite, that Abracadaver was the name of their the first demo, and it had Fuck Me in the Cemetery.
Yeah, yeah.
And
really dark, heavy shit.
It was so good.
So I want a couple other things here, but White Dynamite, that's been going on for a few years now.
Yep.
It's Dave
Craig,
Unger,
Craig, John Darga.
Really good guitar player.
Yep.
Yeah.
I've known him since the Wrecking Crew days. Him and I lived together at 20 Ashford, a famous rock house in Alston, which housed members of Slaughter Shack, Wrecking Crew, Seika. Cam Acklin lived there for a while from the Prime Movers and Voodoo Dolls. So it was like it was like the Addams Family house on a block at 20 Ashford Street.
I have not seen White Dynamite. I've heard a lot of your stuff.
It's amazing.
Joni Lindstrom, when Joni was on my show.
Sorry.
When Joni, it's okay. When Joni Lindstrom was on my show, I let her pick the songs that she wanted, and she's like, White Dynamite. I'm
nice.
Like, okay, we played a White Dynamite song. Dave, I've known since Random Road Mother.
Yep.
So you guys have been friends for a long time.
Yeah.
The guys in the band. So.
Dave played a bunch of keys for Roadsaw. He actually came on the road with us a few times. Behind the bar at the Model for many, many years. He's got a new band called Lip Smear. And him and Sean Drinkwater. So
nice.
I think their first show is tonight.
So. Right. Now, White Dynamite's playing with The Long Wait.
Yep. And Keith Bennett's new band, Casket Rats.
Oh, yeah. I'll be at that show. That's at Notch, right?
Yeah. Notch has they're opening up the garage for live bands now.
So oh, nice.
Good. Yep.
Can't wait. I love going over there.
It's going to be a
night. I don't drink anymore, but I love going over there.
It's going to be a night of 50-year-old punk rock guys who have all played in each other's bands.
Yeah. Well, seeing Jamie from SSD and Mark McKay and those guys together is going to be something special. The whole thing's going to be good.
Glenn Dudley from Wrecking Crew is singing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't want to forget this, but you did a solo record where you had a bunch of different singers on it.
Right.
And then you have another one?
Where things are now, I did a record called Fly Like a Seagull. My wife, Jessica, lovely girl, lovely woman. She's a bit younger than me, so she's not a fan of classic rock. So we're driving along one day and turn on the radio and Fly Like an Eagle by Steve Miller comes on. She goes, this is the fucking dumbest song ever. Fly like an eagle to the sea. Seagulls fly to the sea. Right?
Oh.
And I'm like, fly like a seagull, you know?
Nice.
So that record is as dumb as it sounds. It's about a seagull. It's not what was the book about a seagull? Jonathan Livingston.
Oh, yeah. Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
So it's kind of like that where, you know, seagull's born, seagull dies. But I had written all these songs. I did all the basics with Craig on drums, Craig Riggs. And then I just invited different people to come and sing and play guitar and whatever. And it came out great.
I was looking for it on Bandcamp, but I couldn't find it. Where can I get that record?
It's called TC and the Seaside Assembly.
Is it on Bandcamp?
Yes, it is.
Why couldn't I find it?
I just did a
Tim Katz search and I couldn't find it.
I ended up doing a second one called TC and the Greasy Hearts with Mike Peel.
Yeah, I saw you at New Alliance, and you guys were Mike Peel. Ooh.
Phenomenal.
You always got good drummers, man.
He's amazing, and he's an amazing human as well.
Yeah. It's too bad about Reverse, man, you know?
Yeah.
Shame.
I mean, he's one of the most solid drummers I know, and it was an absolute blast to play with him. And also the thing, just for perspective, I never send demos to people with this stuff. It's like you show up in the studio and you learn the song on the spot.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And because I think it kind of adds a bit of liveliness to the process.
Doesn't it add to the cost of the studio time, though?
Well, it doesn't actually, because I work with only professionals. So like Mike can come in, hear something, and boom, done.
Who did you have? Alec Rodriguez?
Alec Rodriguez,
he's the best, man.
Yep.
I like a lot of engineers in Boston, so I don't mean to just single one out. But Alec,
great.
I know he just went out with Sharon Van Etten and Angel Olsen.
Yeah, he's doing all right.
Yeah. One last thing. I only have one of them, Hangover Palaces, and I pulled it out last night and read a couple chapters to refresh my memory. You're an author. What was the first book called?
Horseshoes and Hand Grenades.
Yeah, those books are basically story, very Bukowski-ish, which makes me like it because I love Bukowski. And you wrote those about real stories pretty much, right?
Pretty much. You know, the names have been changed to protect the innocent. But I just threw two boxes of those in the trash.
What? You did not.
I did. I was moving and I'm like, fuck these, you know?
And I just, oh!
You know, so now they're rare and hard to find.
Wow, I remember when you were doing that first book, because I had a book of poetry, and you asked me how I did it, and I was like, I don't know. I just went to a print place. Yeah. And they...
I mean, I went through a phase where I was trying to be a writer. That's why I went to L.A. And I had scared up some writing gigs, but I didn't really realize the grind of being a journalist. It was really a bit much.
Well, you did a good job, because I like the stuff you wrote, man.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot, dude, for coming down.
Thank you. And one last thing.
Okay.
I have a new record coming out in the fall. My new band's called Horseneck.
New band.
Yeah, it's called Horseneck, and it's me, Ian Ross, Jeremy Heeman, who played drums in Roadsaw, and Neil from Murcielago. And yeah.
So it's a Portland, Boston band.
Yes. Well, you know, you were asking about recording costs. Everybody's got a studio in their homes now.
That's true.
So you can record.
But you were at New Alliance when I saw you. But they're not that expensive.
No, you do the basics, and then you can send tracks out for people to do vocals and stuff at home. So
Horseneck.
Horseneck.
I'm going to look out for that, man.
Thanks.
Thank you, dude.
Thank you, brother.
All right. That was great.
Just like
That track is from one of Tim Cat's most obscure bands, Antler, and that song was called The Gentle Butcher. Nothing gentle about that tune at all. I'll tell you, though, it was a lot of fun catching up with Tim and talking about his long, interesting music career. What about that whole Seiko ordeal? That was something else. This is why I get the rock stars on the show, so we can hear the stories, and lately we have been on a real roll. I just want to remind you folks that we have a Patreon account. You can support the show at patreon.com/TwistedRico, and you can also reach me at any time at TwistedRico@gmail.com. We're also available on all social media platforms, and I urge you to check out our YouTube page where you can actually watch the interview that we did with Tim Katz. Thanks again for listening, and let me remind you that if you go to studio-float.com and you use the code BLOWINGSMOKE10 in the online form, you'll get 10% off your order, which is pretty fantastic. All right, I want to thank Dorchester's own Herb Marsiglio, who's been helping us out with all the tech stuff. And, of course, Shayna Lowe, who has been doing a great job with the booking. Until the next time we say goodbye, this is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Keep the rock and roll alive. Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico is brought to you by Light Street Media.
Stays the friend. Got a bunch of cigarette burns in the back of my head. Bunch of cigarette burns in the words I've said. If I die tonight, hold the hand inside and know that I was never meant for a normal life.
I fucking nailed it.